From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Futurist Alvin Toffler theorized in 1970 that the world was suffering from future shock, dazed by the pace of technological and social change, dizzied by an onrushing future. Well, that future has arrived, and we are still in shock, says my guest today. Present shock, says Douglas Rushkoff, digitally enthralled with an overwhelming now that's pushing out the past, the future, and if we're not careful, our humanity. This hour on Point, Douglas Rushkoff on present shock and the tyranny of the now in the always-on digital life. You can join the conversation. Do you feel it? The overwhelming nowness of so much digital life and emptiness around it. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Douglas Rushkoff joins us in just a second here. But first, let's go in the Wayback Machine. 1970, the book Future Shock. Author Alvin Toffler said we were all overwhelmed by change. We were in shock. Here from the 1972 documentary of the same name, based on Toffler's book, is narrator Orson Welles.
Our modern technology has achieved a degree of sophistication beyond our wildest dreams, but this technology has exacted a pretty heavy price. We live in an age of anxiety, a time of stress, and with all our sophistication, we are, in fact, the victims of our own technological strength. We are the victims of shock, of future shock.
Orson Welles inimitably channeling Alvin Toffler there and future shock. Let's go present. Joining me now from New York is Douglas Rushkoff, high-profile media theorist, teacher, documentary filmmaker, and author of the new book, Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. He's been right before, predicted the centrality of the internet at the dawn of the 90s, coined the term viral media, a big mind out in front on the digital revolution. You can read an excerpt of Present Shock at our website, onpointradio.org. Douglas Rushkoff, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you.
What's the difference between future shock and present shock, Douglas?
Well, it's interesting. Future shock was really about the kind of the human inability to cope with constant change and accelerating change. You know, Toffler actually suggested that we have futurism classes in elementary school so that kids could deal with this, you know, the future that we were careening towards. You know, I feel like we've gotten to that future, you know, at the turn of the millennium, sort of after the Y2K bug didn't happen, or maybe it was a little bit of 9/11 and the collapse of the dot-com market, you know, that we've actually arrived in the future that he was describing. So I guess unlike future shock, present shock is really the human response to living in a world where everything happens now. You know, it's this sort of real-time, always-on existence without a past or a future, without origins or goals. Really, there's just the present. And that can be very disorienting, just as disorienting as rapid change.
What if that's the state that we're in, without a past or a future or origins or goals in mind, what's put us there?
Well, a few things. I mean, on the one hand, it's really just time itself. You know, the industrial age, which was always about careening forward. You know, the industrial age was built on central currency that had a real growth requirement. So we colonized the world. We built. We developed stories from
endless, you know, frontiers of progress.
Exactly, mm-hmm. and industrial progress and growing forward and moving. You know, we kind of reached the limits of our ability to do that. So we kind of, you know, we've hit the sort of the edge of those frontiers at the same time that we've transitioned from really an industrial technological environment to a digital technological environment, and where, you know, the industrial environment was very much about the clock and the clock face, and we watched that second hand go round in a kind of a continuous way. The digital clock, if you remember even your first digital clock, it just sits there like poised. It's 3:23.
Until it just flipped in those days to the next one. I guess not even flip, but just blinked to the next one.
Well, it flipped. No, remember those first ones
with the analog.
Exactly. They're analog digital. They were like those little radio signs. And it just popped. And each time it flipped, it just brought you to a new a new plateau. You know, so that, and that's really the quality of digital time. It's really poised in the moment. It's not that sense of continuity. And every single moment is a new decision point. Do I answer my call waiting? Do I look at my Twitter? Do I catch up with this? Do I answer this ping? You know, this sense of constantly being bombarded by all of these discrete new moments, it leads us sort of chasing a kind of a false presence rather than actually just being in the human present that we really exist in.
I'm trying to get my hands around this. So you're looking at a present where, what, our digital connections are bringing the whole world kind of tumbling in on us all the time, that we're overwhelmed even in that single moment at every moment? Is that the idea?
Yeah, there's this sense, you know, when Google is calling itself, what, Google Now, and everything is so, you know, live and real time, you know, that there's this sort of anxiety that if we're not just keeping up with all of these little feeds and streams of data, if we're not somehow keeping up with it, then we're falling behind. Then we're not really in the moment that everyone else is in or that our technology is in. And there's this There's a false premise there, which is that those things are actually in the present. You know, they're not. They're in the past. Our digital technologies are actually trying to keep up with us when, you know, we think we need to keep up with them.
You talk about a narrative collapse in this situation. I guess this is related to your thinking that what we've sort of peeled away the past. We're not thinking about the future anymore. We are there. We're in it. And so we don't have a big story running through our individual or our shared
right.
lives anymore. Why? Why does shock strip away the sense of us living in story is powerful. Story frames human life, doesn't it? Or is that in the past
right.
tense now?
Well, it can. I mean, and it's not just a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing and a great thing, you know, depending on how you confront it, how you engage with it. You know, stories have been used really since Bible time and before to really organize our reality. You know, we've really got the historic story with the invention of text and the ability to really say this thing in the future is going to happen. I'm going to have a contract. We're going to move towards this other thing. You know, Aristotle was great at understanding how do stories work, where you create this character and put them into peril and you rise the stakes and then come up with a solution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and everything, all of our belief systems are organized narratively, whether it's, you know, Christianity or communism or capitalism or industrialism. You know, but, you know, digital technology has to a large extent broken down those stories, whether it's that we're using our remote controls to break the narrative of a TV show or a commercial or our DVRs going back in time and forward, watching things when we want to, you know, whether we download all of, you know, Netflix, a House of Cards at one moment or not. Even the way we watch stories is kind of disjointed. But then you look at the sorts of stories that we have now. They're much less about beginnings, middles, and ends, and much more about this kind of steady state of interest, whether it's, you know, The Simpsons, which isn't really so much about a story, but about, you know, making connections. That's been around for 20, 25 years now. Or these days, you know, Game of Thrones, which is less about what's going to happen than this kind of never-ending, open-ended quality, which in some ways, I'd argue, is really healthy, especially when you apply it to things like politics and movements. You know, instead of, you know, eyes on the prize journeys or, you know, rallying around a charismatic leader to follow them to their dream, you know, we end up with things like Occupy, which are so confounding on the one hand, but on the other hand, they're mature. They're a kind of a steady state, sort of never-ending game. We're going to be here together and let this thing emerge rather than having these false sort of ends justify the means goals.
Wow. Eyes on the prize is a false end. Of course, you're talking about civil rights there. Some things take a lot of effort and a long time. You got the good and the bad of this. I mean, there was a time when just the phrase, be here now, that was supposed to be all to the good. And now you're kind of saying we are all tied in by our digital gizmos, and it's a mixed blessing.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that there's two nows. I mean, the be here now that, you know, Baba Ram Dass was talking about back in the 60s is the real now. He's talking about the Buddhist now. He's talking about that sort of Tao of being in the moment, that constantly churning, changing moment. You know, in some ways, the digital tools that we're using to address a kind of now isn't the real now. That's a different thing. That's something that's going on somewhere else. You know, whatever happens to be vibrating.
You mean,
know,
how do
vibrating.
I look on Facebook now? Or have I read all of my latest tweets now?
Right. And those are really just portraits of the immediate past. You know, those are rearview mirrors. You know, Facebook creates, you know, it really does create a kind of a present shock in the sense that, you know, friends that you may have had in second grade are suddenly back in your present. You know, all of the distance that time afforded you, you know, between your past and your present really dissolves. It collapses in Facebook where everybody's picture's the same size, your past, your future, it's all just there now. So you lose that, you know, that sense of temporal space, really, between you and what's already happened.
We've got a lot to look at here. Douglas Rushkoff is with us. His new book is Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. Janet Maslin writes the New York Times, Present Shock is one of those invaluable books that makes sense of what we already half know. Here's Joe Walsh, Analog Man. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour maybe about the tyranny of the digital now, when everything pushes in on us right now, and to call sort of to push back. Douglas Rushkoff is my guest, big media theorist. He's written so many big, big books, Siberia, Nothing Sacred, Get Back in the Box, Life, Program or Be Programmed. His latest, his new book is Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. There was a time when the future was supposed to be amazing. We all looked forward to it. The Jetsons.
Meet George Jetson.
Now we're in that future, says Douglas Rushkoff, and it is digitally juiced. And it is overwhelming us in a lot of ways. He writes in this book about how to see it, how to think about it, maybe how to deal with it. Maybe here's an example from the IFC series Portlandia. Carrie Brownstein's character becomes concerned about her friend, played by Fred Armisen, when she realizes he cannot separate himself from his digital life.
One more text. I gotta watch all these movies before they have to return them. Up on my queue and top 10 family photos. Okay, just send one more text. MP3s, I want to put my DVR.
No,
I,
please put
check
it down.
My Facebook update. I can Tumblr.
Fred, wait, please. You know what's happening, right? You're just spiraling. You're out of control.
Yeah.
No, there's too many things going on.
I
want to
check my texts.
You're out, right?
Help me, please.
Help me, please. Douglas Rushkoff, is that the sound of what you're talking about? A bit
in
of
a
it.
In a way, I mean, yeah. I'm a fan of the digital. I mean, I really am. I've been a booster of this. The what I think that we're looking at here, though, is not really the problem of the future so much as the legacy of the past. You know, when digital technology first emerged, I thought, oh my gosh, here we are. We are now going to be free of the industrial age paradigm. Time is no longer going to be money. Now we're going to get to work from home in our own time and do things the way we want and all that. You know, now time can in some ways stop and we're going to get slack. Remember when we used to talk about slack in the early cyber era? I feel like what we've done is we've misapplied the values and strategies of the industrial age to the digital age, and they really don't work that way. So the object of digital technology is not to, you know, fit more algorithms on the head of a pin. It's not to accelerate our stock market. It's not to just look for new ways to get the NASDAQ stock exchange to rise, which is kind of the goal of the 20th century. It's really to now look at, well, what kind of new game can we play here? You know, what's a new order, a new way of organizing ourselves in terms of our work, in terms of our education? I mean, and the digital technology offers us something that I feel like, you know, Wired and so many of the kind of business prognosticators really didn't even consider when they looked, you know, right away to think, how are we going to apply digital back to the good old-fashioned goals of bigger, faster, louder, and better?
As a result, maybe you're right, we are not approaching some Zen state of an infinite moment, completely at one with our surroundings, connected to others, and aware of ourselves on any fundamental level. Rather, you're right, we tend to exist in a distracted present.
Right. Where we could, you know, we could adopt even just one or two of the values that are kind of implicit in our more digital, asynchronous world, the world without narrative, for example. If you start looking at life as a, what James Carse would call an infinite game, right? You're playing this game not to win and end the play. You're playing this game in order to keep the play going. You know, if you start looking at life that way, that's a kind of a presentism, but it's not, it doesn't have to be some great existential crisis. It's that, no, we don't have to end. What if we get to keep on going? What if the world doesn't have to end in an apocalypse? What if instead of imagining, you know, zombies in our future, you know, which is kind of easy to imagine, what if we imagine that we get to keep going? What would that look like?
We just keep going, but there's a lot of apocalyptic sentiment around this present crunch. We'll look at that and more. Douglas Rushkoff's new book is Present Shock. Lots of people responding online, Douglas. Rick says, quick, name any device that lacks an off switch. A more appropriate title for this show might be Voluntary E-Zombies, to your zombie comment. Isaac says, wasn't this the aim of postmodernism? Certainly people have suffered the tyranny of epic narratives in the past. And Loring says, Douglas, please, are we seeing the last gasp of the rational approach of postmodernism driven into absurdity? What do you say?
Absurdity, yes. I mean, we live with that all the time. I think it gets confusing to people when we see this as an entirely digital phenomenon. I mean, for me, like, you know, the idea of present shock occurred to me when I was watching The Real Housewives of Orange County, you know, and I saw these women with, you know, their faces frozen in kind of Botox paralysis, just having misunderstandings over lunch. And as I looked at them, I thought, well, that's why they're having misunderstandings. Their faces are so frozen that no one believes that the other one means anything. One of them says, oh, you know, my daughter might be diagnosed with cancer. And the other one, with her face frozen in a smile, says, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. And the first one doesn't believe her. They have a big misunderstanding. And what I thought when I looked at that is, oh, my gosh, these women, they're so intent on locking in one moment, you know, the moment of their life when they were 29, that they're missing the now that they're actually in, that they're no longer available to one another. And that's the kind of frozenness I'm talking about. You know, it's not just the fact that there's all these digital devices distracting us from now. It's not just that, you know, our Google Calendar wants us to be in 90 places at once. It's that many of us are kind of refusing or incapable right now of embracing what I think is the underlying kind of temporal quality of the 21st century and beyond, which is something way different than what we've experienced before. It really is an opportunity to embrace what's happening right now rather than to stay caught up in the kind of rat race and sort of wheel that we've been on. Because when you accelerate that wheel with digital technology, it really is untenable.
The wheel there, I mean, you think big, so I'm trying to go with you here. You're talking about maybe 1,000 years of this idea of progress toward a future. That is the wheel? That ultimately is a rat race as, you know, it sped up to the point where we could barely keep up with that?
It is. You know, I look at, you know, the invention of text as really the beginning of history. That's when we could write something down and say, okay, 6 months from now, I will give you the corn that you plant today. It's when we got monotheism. It's when we got the Judeo-Christian line. It's when we got the notion of progress. 1,000 years later, you know, we get the clock. We get the analog clock, which did what? It broke down the day into these segments that now we could pay people for an hour instead of paying someone for something that they made, right? Time became money, you know, and then time was literally money. We invented a kind of currency that you lend out at interest and pay back over time. So that's how we got where we are now with this economy that needs to expand with all of this growth paradigm and acceleration toward the future. And now I genuinely believe that digital technology is as big a thing as the invention of mechanical technology or the invention of writing. And it really does bode a the possibility for a different relationship to time, to money, to one another. So instead of having, say, on the business landscape, these big corporations that need to grow and expand in order for the economy to keep going, we get things like Etsy, which is a peer-to-peer marketplace of people actually making things and trading them. We get the possibility for alternative currencies. We have digital devices in our pockets that allow us to do authenticated transactions with one another. What does that do to the Federal Reserve? What does that do to central banking? So I think we're at the very beginning of a good several centuries of watching ourselves become something more and different than our industrial age selves, than our clock-based, time-based selves. And we start to really approach problems more from the perspective of sustainability than victory. You know, these kind of chronic problems that we're dealing with, which aren't as easy as just going to the moon and sticking a flag in the surface or winning a war and beating the bad guys. You know, we're kind of growing up and realizing we're here to stay. So we're going to have to start solving things in a more ongoing, presentist, sustainable fashion.
We have to grow up and make that change of perspective, or else the rat race wheel goes. I mean, you call it almost a playing off of schizophrenia here. You call it digifrenia when we're trying to, I guess, in a way, apply the old behavioral model to this new world of technology, Douglas.
Right. I mean, digital technology is really good at copying things. It just so happens, as you know, being analog people, we can't make copies of ourselves. You know, digifrenia is really what I see as the problem of digital technology for most of us, which is not information overload. I've never really had – I can, like he says, turn it to an off switch. I'll turn it off. The problem with digifrenia is even when you turn it off, you are still there. There's an instance of you on Twitter. There's an instance of you on Facebook. There's an instance of you in your email inbox. There are all of these yous out there that are sort of existing simultaneously. You know, I had this bizarre moment in the lobby of a hotel in Berlin where I was trying to log into my Google Calendar after trying on the plane and trying at the airport. And Google finally told me, I'm sorry, you seem to be logging in from too many places at once. So not even Google believed that I was me anymore because I had too many sort of simultaneous existences. And that's the kind of confusion, I think, that can result when you've got all these different selves running simultaneously.
Douglas Rushkoff is with us. His new book is Present Shock. Douglas, lots of listeners lining up to talk with you. Alex in Nashville, Tennessee is calling. Hi, Alex. You're on the air with Douglas Rushkoff.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I'm a family therapist, and I talk with a lot of kids, a lot of parents, a lot of teachers. And honestly, if you kept me on the air, I would probably talk for an hour about kids texting. But one thing I do see that's very disturbing as a trend is I see that kids are getting very, very smart in this maladaptive response to the mass of data that is the present. And this idea of the loss of story to me seems to be very much connected to a loss of a sense of individuality. And I could speak about, you know, it's really sad. You ask a kid 20 years ago, what do you want to be? An astronaut, president. You ask a kid what they want to be today. But they don't even have any idea. They're too busy texting. But that's not so much my primary concern. It's just as someone in the business of specifically social services, what I see is that the loss of story coincides with a loss of ability to follow an argument.
Yeah.
And I see with kids a loss of ability to follow an argument is also a loss of ability to be effectively political, effectively citizens. Idealism is really just a mask of, zeal bought into wholesale. But probably most disturbing is that, if there's a false present, Kierkegaard would say the only place ethics is in the present. The only place eternity is in the present. And so I see a loss of moral compass, which pervades my own field, scientific research.
Alex, you said a mouthful right there. Let us pick it up. Just to scoot it one step further, Diane writes online here, we have lost our souls. We'll look at all of it. Douglas, I'm sure you're listening carefully to Alex in Nashville. He's singing a lot of your tunes there, the loss of story, loss of ability to follow an argument. And what about when we come to ethics in this new framework? Pick up on those.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. There's the loss of a certain compass, you know, and I'm trying not to be one of the people who's pining to get that one back, but rather looking at what can emerge as the new compass in this new landscape. You know, and there's a lot of things that can. I mean, in a super simple one is, you know, so we lose the industrial age clock and we lose shift work and we lose all that. You know, what kind of sense of time can we get in the moment? You know, and it turns out there's a lot. We're doing new research now on biological clocks, for example. It's a really simple one. You know, it used to be thought of, you know, like jet lag used to be thought of as folklore and superstition until Major League Baseball managers realized that their pitchers did better going East Coast to West Coast than they did West Coast to East Coast.
Yeah, but speak to the heart
of it. This is real.
Yeah, I get that.
Right.
But here's Alex. I mean, he's a therapist. He's working with kids. They're texting away, and he can't find that they're there anymore. They're sort of lost in the stream of text.
Right.
But lost
that's
unto themselves,
because,
maybe.
It's partly because the they're there that used to guide these kids became really abused by advertisers, by corporate capitalism, the way we were given, most of us anyway, to orient ourselves, turned out to be corrupt, right? Oh, you're going to have a career and guide towards that. Well, where's my pension? What happened? Oh, well, we don't give you a pension anymore. Have a 401k. Oh, do a 401k. Well, wait a minute. The stock market went down, not up. Now what? All of when goal after goal and story after story turns out not to be true, people then have to look for their guidance in the moment. I mean, in some sense, the modern Christians have got this right when they're putting these little wristbands on kids that say, "What would Jesus do?" It's a fascinating approach to a kind of a presentist ethic, you know, where the reason we don't, you know, throw a piece of plastic in the street is not because we're looking 10,000 years in the future of that piece of plastic, but because we're right now realize this is not the way I want to live.
But you're right, Douglas, you say, how do we tell stories and convey values without the time required to tell a linear story?
It's hard. We end up doing it. These days we do it, you know, so far through video games, you know, sort of the new dominant entertainment medium. And while on the one hand right now video games are largely just about shooting things, the structure of video games does offer me some hope. The idea that rather than following some heroic character through their journey, now it's my journey. I am the one in real time making choice after choice after choice, which feels much more like what life feels like today. You know, it is going to be a rocky transition. I agree that kids are far from being the digital natives I anticipated, you know, 10, 20 years ago. You know, they are, in some sense, the most likely to fall prey to the ever-present ping of the SMS message. But it is up to us to help them find ways to reorient and to reorient to what's happening right now rather than these sort of more long-term stories that aren't quite working so well anymore.
Well, the ever-present ping of the text message. Douglas Rushkoff is with us. His new book is Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. Hear the Flaming Lips with All We Have Is Now. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the tyranny, maybe, of the digital now when everything pushes in on us right now. And a call to push back, never mind future shock. Douglas Rushkoff's new book is Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. He joins us from New York. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Even in politics, that's sort of, here we are. This is us. This is what there is. Has come right into the heart of our political life. Here's a little tape, Super Tuesday, 2008, Chicago, then Senator Barack Obama, borrowing that title of an essay by author Alice Walker to inspire the nation to make a change. We are, you recall.
Change will not come if we wait for some other person or if we wait for some other time. We are the ones we've been waiting for. We. We are the change that we seek.
Senator Barack Obama, 2008, Douglas Rushkoff, you point right at that phrase, those phrases, Alice Walker to Barack Obama to us, in your book, President Shock. What's being demonstrated? What's being manifested there?
Well, it's interesting. At least what's being referred to there is the phenomenon that we're talking about here, is that, you know, politics and activism and our movement towards our goals is changing from we're going to do this in order to get that, we're going to fight now to win tomorrow, to much more about, no, we are going to manifest that thing. The way we act now is our activism. I mean, it's very even Marx talked about politics getting to this point at some place. The irony here is that he used it for a campaign but didn't actually govern in that fashion. You know, it was like when he became president, I felt, me and many of my friends who kind of wanted to be the change, we didn't feel that we instantly or got that opportunity as he came into office. It seemed like business as usual, which is why I think the Occupy movement came up after that. I think the Occupy movement really was Obama's campaign manifesting in this other way. And if you remember how unnerving it was, because, you know, the reporters would go there and say, well, what do you want? What are your goals? When does this end? And they'd say, you know, well, we're doing the thing. You know, we're not going to state demands for some future. We're doing this thing now. And it doesn't have to end. We see this as an ongoing sort of a steady state, you know, a new praxis, if you will, a new approach to engaging with activism is something that we do rather than something that we long for.
You may be right, though. I've got listeners saying here, you know, writing in, whoa, Rushkoff's got no research on Occupy, which has done a ton of planning. This is annoying.
I was part of Occupy. Yeah. I was there. I'm not saying there wasn't a lot of planning. I'm saying that Occupy was not meant as something that we're going to work hard now so that 10 years from now we win an election, so that we get some campaign. Occupy was true to itself in the actual way it happened. Occupy was not about stating demands to the political process that then someone has to respond to. Occupy was about finally just doing it. There was tremendous planning and a better infrastructure. That's why Occupy Sandy worked. That's why Occupying the Debt works now, because it turns out that when people actually get extremely practical and presentist about things, they often get much more done than if they try to do something now for some future thing. I'm not saying that one is necessarily better than the other, but the Occupy movement seems much more consonant with this sort of this presentist digital world in which we're no longer yearning towards conclusion, but trying to manifest things right now.
Douglas Rushkoff has signed off of Facebook publicly as part of his effort to get a handle on that presentist digital world. But not everybody has. Ron is writing to us on Facebook. He says, there's a dark side to this information overload. It's the rise of radical opinion media. People feel lost in the flood of info and cling to anyone who acts as a filter, who says this is what it means, which sort of picks up on one of your points, a dynamic you're talking about here, people desperately grasping for real-time pattern recognition in the flood of info. You call it fractal noia. What do you mean, Douglas?
Yeah, well, fractal noia is a fun one. It's one of the sort of syndromes I talk about in the book. And fractal noia is when, if you no longer have stories and history, sort of cause and effect logic to understand the world you're in, it's very easy to kind of fall prey to an almost paranoid style of pattern recognition. You know, if you don't have a story to understand something, you have to kind of understand the world as a snapshot. You just look at the landscape, you look at the snapshot, and you make sense of things by drawing connections between various things, almost like, you know, like living in the television show Lost, you know, where there's this part of the island and that.
Yeah.
How does it all connect? You know, there's no time anymore. They're traveling back and forward in time anyway. And when you have to draw connections between lots of things, you can end up drawing connections between things that aren't really connected at all. But it's because you need some sort of underlying logic to organize your experience.
Watch out for that dynamic. Let's go to New Orleans and Alan. Alan, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Douglas Rushkoff.
Thank you. My question and concern is the idea that nothing is ever forgotten now. Everything is photographed, memorialized, websited, and I think it is almost analogous to the fact that in our era we are constantly eating and are malnourished, and so we have these, you know, kind of fat brains with information that I don't think is, it's easy for people to see the patterns you're talking about just because of the, well, I use the word cloud, but I mean it in the old sense mm-hmm. of
fog
of you know, the fog of information that's around us.
Yes, you put your finger on something that Rushkoff writes about. Douglas, what about it? Nothing forgotten.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, if nothing's forgotten, then you never really have a past anymore. Your past is always with you. You know, that bong hit that some high school kid, you know, got photographed on Facebook never goes away, right? It's there forever, always in his present.
Apart from the embarrassment, why is that a problem?
Well, because maybe it shouldn't have to be a problem, right, that we're always with our past. But as most of us have grown up, the past is something that happened a long time ago. You know, there's that distance. You can change as a person, you know, and it's very hard to change when your past is always right there in front of you.
Crowding the present in a way.
Crowding the present, right, in a way that doesn't give you that experience of moving forward. And the interesting sort of the corollary to this that he's alluding to is, you know, all of our past behavior becomes part of the cloud of big data, you know, that many companies and market researchers are using to figure out what is our next most probable step. So, you know, there's companies that know which 13 and 14-year-old kids on Facebook are going to turn out to be gay. They know who's pregnant and who's not pregnant. You know, they create shows, even like House of Cards was developed by Netflix using big data research about, well, what are people who like this actor and maybe like that director, what kind of story are they going most likely to like? But it does lead to that kind of emptiness. It's as if our future isn't being kind of thought up by people, but it's almost developed by machine based on what our past was. You know, it's that kind of empty taste of the sort of mechanically reproduced cheese doodle. You know, it's like you eat a lot of them, but they're never quite satisfying. And that's because there's not really humans on the other end. There's just manipulation of our past data in order to create the future products that we'll be most likely to buy.
Alan in New Orleans, thanks for your call. Marie in Centerville, Massachusetts. Marie, you're on the air with Douglas Rushkoff.
Thank you. I'm calling because I look at my college students and I see people who are not presentist, they're immediatist. If it doesn't happen right now, they don't have the wherewithal to stick around and make it happen later. And I don't think that that's necessarily everyone, but I think that it's a big side effect of digital immediatism.
What does that enable them to do or disable them from doing, Marie?
Well, it disables them from concentrating on anything for more than 20 minutes. I have students often who cannot read at length, who can't sustain a good argument for me, who can't go out and build a big pile of research because it takes too much time. And they're not used to things that take too much time that are not instantly giving them feedback. And I worry about that. It's, again, not everyone, but I see more and more of it every year.
Douglas, how about it? We can all, respond to that, I think, with observations of our own, and it's frightening if it's true.
Absolutely. That's why I wrote the book. I mean, that's exactly it. She has students who are, a majority of them are in present shock rather than genuine presentism, right? They're not using digital technology to give them more choice over how they use their time. I mean, if you think back to the early internet, you know, I thought, you know, I was on this thing called The Well, which was a bulletin board. And the beauty of The Well was this online conversation. You would download the conversation using your modem. You would sit up for hours thinking about the paragraph that you were going to mm-hmm. write to participate in that conversation. Then you'd upload it. And you would sound smarter on the internet than you were in real life, because the internet gave you all the time in the world. It was atemporal. It doesn't live in time. But our kids are so, I mean, and partly it's because of the way we make these interfaces and the companies behind them, but they end up so addicted to these pings that they try to keep up with them as if they were current, as if that's what's going to bring them into the moment. But it's not.
So
it actually takes them out of the moment.
The analog and digital clocks tick on us. How do we harvest the benefits of this age without being gutted or flattened or turned into sort of blank immediatists?
Well, I think it's by taking charge of our time by, I mean, in the one sense, it was the title of my last book, you know, Program or Be Programmed.
Yep.
Learn how to use digital technology in a way where you are making it conform to what you need, to your patterns, to your humanity, rather than conforming your humanity to it. You know, and that's why I think one of the biggest problems is my peers who are out there talking about the singularity and how technology is going to overtake humanity and how machines are smarter than people or information is just on an inexorable evolution towards greater states of complexity and human beings are just one quaint step in its journey. You know, no, that has the medium and the message reversed, right? we are the humans. You know, the information is here to serve us and not the other way around. And the more we can do that, take back your time. I mean, gosh, writing a book, you know, is the most radical thing about having written this book. You know, to say that people are going to actually
the time invested in it, the time
people are going to spend 7 hours mm-hmm. with one author. You know, but that's a matter of saying, acknowledging that. Oh my gosh, I am asking someone to surrender their digital autonomy for 7 hours at a time to engage with these thoughts as an individual from one person. You know, that's. But that's it. You know, it's looking into other people's eyes, being in the room with people, turning off your phone, taking back your time is something that's all you've got, you know, is your time from here to the end. You know, so start looking at that. I mean, it's what the Jews did. As soon as we got text, they invented the Sabbath. You know, it's to take a day off.
Douglas Rushkoff writes, we can stop the onslaught of demands for our attention. We can create a safe space for uninterrupted contemplation. We can give each moment the value it deserves. Joan in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on the air, Joan.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you think?
But I have 2 points. The first one is my father is dying. I asked him what was one of the main things that he thought was important. And he said that 50% of what he did in his life was based on what other people thought. And I think with the way everything is instantaneous, it stops people from being able to necessarily do what they want to do because you have a constant audience. And so you're thinking, mm-hmm. okay, if I do this, what will other people think? So I think it stifles your ability to necessarily be an individual. And the second thing is, as a 50-year-old woman, there are elements of my past that I want to leave behind. There are people and experiences and memories that I don't necessarily care to relive. And I think it doesn't give you the chance to reinvent yourself if your past is always there, if you're the threat, if you will, of someone stepping out and saying, hey, yeah, but remember back in such and such when you did such and such?
Yes.
It, you know, it's a problem for me. I don't want to be on Facebook. I resent that there's information I want to access, and I can't do it unless I'm a member of Facebook.
Joan, I so appreciate your call, and I wish your family and your father grace in his passing, if that's what it comes to, Joan. But I appreciate your call. Douglas, what do you say?
I mean, her two points are so related too. I mean, it makes me think about, you know, when I was a kid, I would, you know, go to one of those stores in the mall and buy little posters and things, and I'd put them on the walls of my room. You know, so it was at my experience of culture. I reflected back to me in my room. Maybe a friend would come in my room occasionally and say, oh, that poster's cool or that one's nerdy now. But a kid today, they don't put stuff on the wall of their room. They put it on the wall of Facebook. So that very private process of sort of self-development is now public performance. It's out there, right? And so to her father's point, you know, it's performative. It's broadcast. And then it's not only that, it's there forever. And then it's not only that, it's what marketers and other people are going to use to figure out what to offer you. You know, so there's this It's both broadcast, it's destiny determining, and it's permanent. And that puts a lot of pressure on a 11, 12, 13, 14-year-old kid who just wants to experiment and figure out who they are, you know, to do that in public and permanently. it's got to be a lot of pressure.
I read you saying people assert your humanness here, assert a kind of a human usage of time, sense of time. Don't just plug in and let technology drive your pace.
Right. It's basically that's it. You know, it's that we mistook the time on the clock for human time, right? Back in the analog day. In the digital day, now that we see what time is, it's just this number. It really is just that number. It doesn't have a lot to do with who we are. Yeah, you got to get to work and you got to get tuned into the radio show. You got to do that. But that clock does not define you, right? You are moving through a very different aliveness. You know, we're living on a human temporal landscape that if we can get back in touch with that and start feeling what that's about, I think we're going to be a lot happier and a lot less vulnerable to the constant pings from our digital simulations.
Douglas Rushkoff's new book is Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. He joined us from New York. Douglas Rushkoff, thank you so much.
Oh, gosh, thanks for your time.
Listeners, be with us tomorrow. Breakfast at Tiffany's is back. It's on the Broadway stage. We'll talk with the director and the actor who plays the new Holly Golightly. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.